need to reflect on and to think about these matters in order to find solutions, God willing. What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. We should understand this period and this important event properly and introduce it to future generations. I strongly believe that if our succeeding generations learn about the important, meaningful aspects of the Sacred Defense and realize how the Iranian nation was able to reach the heights of victory in this important event and to stand up there with power and pride, they will learn great lessons from it and they will achieve great things. This is my firm opinion. The greatness of this event must be recognized. Much has been done in this field. Books have been written, films have been made, and memoirs have been narrated. However, in my opinion, there is still much more room for work to be done. Up until now, we have not been able to recognize or make known the details of this great, colorful painting. We are looking at it from a distance. But if we look at it closely, we will find that in every piece of it, there is so much beauty, so many fine points, and so much meaning and depth that one is amazed. Each piece of it is like this, and this information must be made known to people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all I said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone. Small pills and push me to sleep, but you can't change my dreams, they're too deep. You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all I said.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Kazmi. In this show, we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. I'm delighted to be joined today by the tireless campaigning barrister, Frank McGuinness. Frank was born in Dublin, was raised in the occupied six counties in the north of Ireland, and was called to the bar of England and Wales in 2016, practicing in the areas of criminal defence, civil law and public law. He's worked against states, employers and landlords, and has a particular expertise in claims relating to Palestinians and anti-Zionists in the struggle against Israeli colonialism and genocide. Thank you very much for joining me today, Frank.
Great to be here, comrade. Thank you for having me.
Some critics were saying, Iran is firing all of these ballistic missiles and so many of them are being shot down, even though many of them did hit and caused extensive damage in Tel Aviv and Haifa. And in order to stop those missiles over those 12 days, Israel and the US had to expend so much money, so many missiles to take down the Iranian ones. In fact, you had, I think it was about 150 US THAAD missiles being expended. That's 25% of the United States' entire stock, such that the Pentagon was getting worried about the US's ability to defend itself if something kicked off with China. And those 150 THAAD missiles will cost something like $2 billion to replace over at least 1 year of rebuilding. And then even Israel's own long-range air defense system can also be depleted. So eventually it would have come to the point that Iran would have won in that sort of war of attrition. But I apologize because I interrupted you on a very important point about nuclear weapons.
Well, I want to answer your question, which was about, you know, Palestine action and what does it tell us about the course of terrorism. But so I was trying to make the point that, look, the British state is really invested in this. And then I sort of made a size point about how Britain's little loyal Jewish Ulster, like, is a colonial project. It's an advancement of initially British imperial and now sort of NATO US imperial power in the region. It's primarily a military function, that's my understanding, but it does have some interesting economic functions as well, right? And it needs a great power backer to function. And Britain backs it, and British foreign policy seems to be entirely subservient to American foreign policy. You saw that with the Iraq war, and you see that now, right? And so the crisis of Zionism is a crisis for British imperial hegemony and US imperial hegemony, right? And so that's why our enemies are on the back foot, in my opinion, right? Zionism is in a crisis. We can talk about why, but it just seems very obvious to me, right? Even liberals must accept that, right? ICC arrest warrants. You have to arrest the prime minister of one of your closest allies if he comes to your own territory. The ICJ is about to determine whether or not you're genocidal, has already determined that you're an apartheid state. Like, even within the extremely colonial, racist, problematic terrain of international law, the conclusions of those courts are like, yeah, even we have to admit, like, this is too much, right? So crisis of Zionism is a crisis of British imperial hegemony. They're like, we're losing control of this narrative. We're losing control over our ability to protect power into the Middle East. And I think the factor that's often understated, I mean, you mentioned China, but I don't think a lot of the mainstream discourse talks about China because it's almost like this taboo. Like, China is becoming extremely powerful. It's not wasting loads of its men and women, like its soldiers and its military resources on obnoxious, fruitless, horrific wars like Ukraine, and it's certainly not participating in a genocide and thereby obliterating its own standing in the international community. It's not chewing its way through international law and just tearing up the so-called international rules-based order in pursuit of, like, Jewish nationalism, like Jewish ethno-nationalism and genocide. So China's waiting in the wings to be like, all right, go ahead. Like, China's frankly laughing, just like, wow, why are you doing this? And the answer is that it's a crisis. The crisis of Zionism is a crisis of U.S. global hegemony. And that crisis, of course, has an effect on Britain, which is a subordinate ally of the United States. And so, you know, let's empathize with our enemies for a moment. What is the British state to do when faced with the sheer scale of public anger at Britain's active participation in this genocide? What is to be done about that? The Zionism had this very powerful ideology that insulated it from criticism, right? If you criticize the Jewish state, then you hate Jews, and, you know, this is the only way for Jews to be safe in the wake of the Holocaust, and all this kind of stuff that was designed to distract attention from the fact that it was a colonial project, it was arguably fascist, certainly ethno-nationalist, and it was premised upon the mass murder and deliberate ethnic cleansing of non-Jewish Palestinians because Zionism construes them as a racial threat to the desired purity, right, the demographic racial purity of an ethno-state, right? So this disgusting, overtly violent, overtly colonial racist project insulates itself by reference to these very sophisticated, emotional appeals about the Holocaust and the need to defend Jews. That's all breaking down. And everyone's like, what? So just so we're clear, because the horrific violence of the Holocaust happens, that means that we need to have endless violence, not just against Palestinians because they're the wrong race, but also against all of Israel's neighbors and even countries as far away as Iran. Like, and everyone can just say, like, no, this is insane, actually. And so it's like the veil has totally slipped. Zionism is in terminal crisis, I think. I think it's melting down. I don't think it's going to survive this. And so the British state is trying. I really think our enemies are on the back foot. And I'm not trying to downplay the horrific cost to Palestinians. It is truly horrific. I can't even really imagine it. I think it will take time as the human family for us to really psychologically, emotionally reckon with the sheer scale of the ongoing slaughter that's happening while you and I are speaking. It's like we're all completely changed by it. It's horrific. Like, I feel emotional even just talking about it. It's almost like you have to compartmentalize to keep functioning. It's just so horrific what we're witnessing, right? And it's the sheer impunity of it, I think, that's really staggering. Like the Zionist, the specifically Jewish-Israeli Zionist mentality, the self-victimization, the narcissism, the belief that Jewish trauma is the only thing that matters, and that it can justify the most horrific open dehumanization of Palestinians. Like, it's a staggering affront to all of our humanity. And not to overstate it, but part of the silver lining of the fact that Zionism seems to be dying is that we have to, part of that is to try and rehabilitate. You know, this is idea, there's an analogy with the denazification process that happened in Germany. I appreciate that will be regarded as incendiary, but it's a necessary.
I do think, though, to be honest, that's overstated, because whilst you had the Nuremberg trials, you also had Operation Paperclip. You also had
I was just in Berlin. Like, they have not denazified. It's horrific. The violence of the German police in Berlin, like, is staggering. Like, I'm not here to endorse the Metropolitan Police, but like by contrast, I mean, partly that's a function of the fact that the marches in London are so big that the Met are just like, we must not antagonize this movement because it is too big and we can't control it. And you can see that with that funny little interaction between Swala Braverman and the chief of the Met police, where she was like, we need to ban this march because they're gonna disrupt our war debt or whatever. And the chief of the Met was like, you can't do that, not just as a matter of law. You could see that it was like, if you start trying to ban marches, you're gonna have a problem. It's gonna drive people into the arms of Palestine Action. Now look, I appreciate I'm giving you a very meandering answer. You asked me about Palestine Action and I've sort of talked about everything, but I am coming to that. The short answer is Zionism is in crisis. That creates a problem for the US and for Britain, and Britain is decidedly on the back foot on this issue. And so the British government has tried to stem the tide, but it keeps coming up against this Streisand effect, right? So you see it with NECAP, which again, same act, terrorism act, right? Like, your man is alleged to have run around on stage with a Hezbollah flag, Liam Oak, and they're like, okay, we're going to prosecute you now. And it's like, why did you do that? He's a folk hero now. You turned him into like this, you immortalized him. He will forever be this guy who did this during, like, you know, allegedly did this thing during a genocide. They made a hero out of him. Idiots, right? Massive mistake. Same with PAL Action. They're like, are we going to look really stupid if we do this? Like, can we do this? Can we just prescribe them as terrorists? And everyone's like, really? Like, so I think it's a mistake. I'm not trying to be smug or complacent, but you can just see by the way that it's been received.
Well, people are outraged, and even others who you might not expect, like liberals and even conservatives, have voiced unease at the decision to ban Palestine Action. But could you talk a bit about the legal process that's now happening? Because you had this situation where an application for judicial review was brought against the British government by Huda Amouri, who co-founded Palestine Action, and Mr. Justice Chamberlain gave permission for that application, and what that means is that the judicial review can now go ahead for the benefit of our viewers and listeners. But there was also this application for interim relief, which would have meant that in the meantime, while the judicial review process goes ahead, the ban on Palestine Action would have been temporarily lifted. But he didn't grant that interim relief.
I'm very disappointed that he didn't have the, I would say, courage to grant interim relief. It is interesting that the Court of Appeal, out of hours, was robed up and ready to go. So even if he had done the right thing and said, you know what, this is really disturbing, this attempt to, this order prescribing Palestine Action is a staggering affront to civil liberties, and I do have serious concerns about it, I'm granting interim relief, so the order will not come into effect until such time as we've heard a proper legal challenge. The Court of Appeal was there, and it's clear the Court of Appeal was not there to challenge his decision to refuse interim relief. The Court of Appeal was there ready to correct any decision that he might have made about interim relief. That's my read on it, right? But to come back to this Streisand effect thing, you saw this group in Scotland, Stop Leonardo, springing up. So the Streisand effect is already happening.
Could you just explain what you mean by the Streisand effect?
So obviously the Streisand effect is Barbara Streisand had a home on the beachfront or something, and she didn't want people to know about it, and so she tried to have a photo taken down, and it had the opposite effect. Once it became apparent she was trying to hide something, everyone wanted to know what she was hiding, and so the photo went viral.
You see this all the time. When people try to ban a book or ban a film or ban a song, then people intrinsically, because of human nature, want to know about it more. Or you're trying to keep something from me. Now I want to know about it. You're trying to stop me from doing something. Now I want to participate in it. And of course, it should also be clarified, the fact that they've prescribed Palestine Action doesn't mean that they've prescribed direct action as a tactic. Obviously, people who engage in direct action do so at their own risk. If they're doing something like criminal damage or something that's potentially unlawful, they obviously run the risk of potentially being prosecuted for that. But they're not necessarily going to be prosecuted for being terrorists because they've gone and done something akin to what Palestine Action was doing before.
So I do think... Again, forgive me if I'm being overly playful and meandering, but I find it really interesting thinking these things through with you, right? And I think, you know, we were talking about the crisis of Zionism and how that registers as a crisis of British imperial hegemony. And I do think, you know, putting my lawyer hat on for a moment, I do think it's necessary to go into court and to name this crisis in open court. Just say the British state is participating actively in this genocide. The British state has for almost two centuries been deeply committed to this bizarre racist fantasy of a little loyal Jewish Ulster. That fantasy is based in no small part on British imperial anti-Semitism. Like, all of this stuff is very, very easy to go into court and say if you have the right politics, the right client, and it's happening at the right moment, right? And this is something I said when I was in Berlin recently talking to the comrades there, and they have it even worse than us, if you can imagine. You know, I was sort of saying that there's this guy, Jacques Vergès, that I'm fond of quoting, and I owe thanks to my friend Rob Knox, who introduced me to that thinker, right? He was a lawyer practicing in French-occupied Algeria and pioneered this idea of a strategic distinction between connivance and rupture. And you can't just go into court and wish that there was a ruptural moment. There has to be a mass movement. And then because there's a mass movement, that empowers you to go into court and just say, like, you and whose army? Like, your court doesn't have the power to stop us. And that was what was happening with the FLN, right? The FLN people being charged with these terrorism offences, there's that word again, and Vergès was going in with their, instructions, and they would pioneer this strategy together, according to which they would just go in and say, we're the FLN, like, we have a mass movement outside, and we're committed to driving your state, the French state, out of our country. We don't recognise your court. And once you get to a certain level of militancy, you can do that. So that's the crisis, and Palestine Action is one of the most obvious symptoms of it. We need to keep up the pressure. We need to keep saying we need to keep escalating. It's a genocide. It's beyond urgent. But in my opinion, the British state, because it's in such a crisis, because it's on the back foot, because the social relations on which Zionism were built, according to Patrick Hannes, have now become completely visible. And so the Zionist project is no longer capable of defending itself from the theoretical blows directed at it, but also the physical blows. It couldn't defend itself against October 7th, and it can't defend itself against those Iranian missile strikes. So I think the best defense is always a good offense, and any lawyers listening to this or any people going into court having to defend themselves in cases relating to Palestine should simply go in and calmly, without moral judgment, dispassionately, because that's the style that the British state and its courts prefer, you just go in and you just say, who cares what the British Empire thinks? You're participating in this genocide. You may retain some legal authority because I'm in your court, but your moral authority has collapsed, your political authority has collapsed, and I personally don't recognize what you have to tell me about my alleged wrongdoing and my racism. I did a tweet, or I smashed up an arms factory, non-violent direct action against property. I didn't murder any Palestinian children, did I? I didn't run spy flights over a little loyal Jewish Ulster while the rabid, fanatical fascists engage in mass murder and genocide. You did all that? You, the British state, are doing that? I don't care what you think. I'll listen to what you say, and I'll engage with it critically, but you have no authority to judge me. There reaches a moment when you're able to provoke that kind of a rupture in court, and in my opinion, that's the moment we've reached. And I'll give you just one example. I've been representing a lot of professionals recently, right? Solicitors, barristers, doctors, in front of their respective professional regulators, right? So it's a prosecution, but it's a non-criminal regulatory prosecution aimed at punishing professionals for alleged wrongdoing or transgression of their professional duties and obligations. And in most of those cases, the regulator seems to prefer pursuing, you know, strike-off, like depriving these professionals of their right to practice. There's a well-publicized case involving Ghassan Abu Sitter, like absolute hero. British Palestinian doctor who went to save people's lives in the middle of a genocide, put himself at great risk, lived through literal war crimes while the Zionist fascists were attacking hospitals he was working at, and yet he was dragged in front of his regulator. Those kinds of cases are what I'm talking about. And so some of the professionals I've been representing, we have now reached a point where you just go in and you say, well, hold on a second. You know, my guy did some tweets or whatever, or did a Facebook post, or said something you don't like. You're part of the British state. That you're engaged in the mass murder of Palestinian children right now, aren't you? Like, who cares what you think about racism? And you literally say this, like, obviously, perhaps not quite that tone. In my opinion, we've reached a point where it's perfectly possible to go into court and say that sort of stuff.
But
and that's the winning strategy.
I agree, but it's also quite tedious to have to keep doing this over and over again, because this is an example of Zionist lawfare. So I think it's worth spelling out, in my experience of working with the Left Legal Fighting Fund, how Zionist lawfare works. So in terms of the work that I've done, I've helped to support employees who have posted something about Israel on social media, and then they've been targeted by their employers. And we've been highly successful in many cases of stopping people being disciplined, stopping them being fired from their jobs. But for the Zionists, this is all a very low-cost endeavor, and it's a very parasitic way of operating, where effectively Zionists occupy or harass institutions and spread their malign influence to get them to do their bidding. So a classic example of that would be when the Equality and Human Rights Commission in Britain launched an investigation into the Corbyn-led Labour Party for supposed anti-Semitism. That investigation was triggered by two pro-Israel groups, the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the self-styled Jewish Labour Movement. Now, the bulk of that work and expense was carried out by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, not by the CAA, the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, or the Jewish Labour Movement. So those two Zionist organizations effectively outsourced all the work to a different body. And again, when it comes to employers or media organizations or political parties or professional regulators, whatever the case may be, they do all of the heavy lifting against anti-Zionists after receiving pressure from Zionist groups. So can you talk a bit about that and what we can do to counter that? Because it seems like we're playing whack-a-mole.
Absolutely. Very interesting question. I mean, you're basically talking about strategy. What's the best strategy for dismantling Zionism? And when you talk about Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, making submissions to the EHRC and then getting the British state, you know, a part of the British state, a Blairite institution, obviously, to investigate the Corbyn-led Labour Party. Like, there's a whole load of moving parts there. Why is that attack met with such a receptive? Why does it fall on such fertile soil when it's made to these various British state institutions? Because British state institutions, like, yeah, we agree with you. Like, we're Zionist. We agree with there being this insane, like, ethno-state that ethnically against Palestine. We agree with all of that, and that's why we're so receptive to your submissions. Now, you know, as the left, we could try to do this kind of, I'd like to speak to the manager strategy, which is basically a campaign against anti-Semitism and UKLFI in a nutshell. They're just like, I'm outraged. I want to speak to the police, or I want to speak to a regulator. Like, they're just curtain-twitching little dweebs. Like, that's their whole strategy. Like, we could adopt that strategy. I think it's pathetic. Like, I mean, where I come from, snitches get stitches, and we don't, we don't complain like that. Like, oh, I want to speak to the manager. But we can mock them for being such, so pathetic and just constantly appealing to the authority of the British Empire. Like, I don't recognize that authority. I'm not going to go to the British Empire and be like, oh, like, because they just won't be receptive to my politics, right? That's the point. They're just going to be really unreceptive to it. They're like, oh, no, but we like this. We're the British Empire. We do colonial violence. Like, that's fine. So that's part of the picture. Like, our strategy can't be to just reproduce the stupid right-wing Zionist strategy, because they're on different terrain.
I think what you say about not trying to mirror the Zionist strategy makes sense, because we don't have access to those institutions in the same way that they do. And that means we have to be more creative in coming up with our own solutions to all of these different problems. But unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. So thank you very much, Frank, for joining me. See you on the next one.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important topic. That is, in fact, an ethical topic, a issue related to one of the encouraged moral characteristics that Islam has encouraged. I'm speaking, of course, of the virtue of clemency, which in Arabic we call hilm. Could also be translated as forbearance or patience. There's probably some minute differences between these, which should be discussed in its own relevant place. The topic that we want to open up today and discuss is what exactly brings about clemency. Everybody knows clemency is virtuous. The question that's most pertinent for people is, how can I become a clement person? How can I become a forbearing person? In order to answer this very significant question, we need to take inspiration from the hadiths, which have been narrated from the infallibles regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said, with the profusion of the intellect, clemency flourishes. So one of the things that can create clemency and forbearance in a person is his increase in his intellect and his knowledge. The more a person knows, the more a person is learned, the more wise he is, the more clement he will become. In another beautiful hadith, which kind of echoes the same theme of the first one, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, incumbent upon you is clemency, alayka bil hilm, For verily it is the fruit of knowledge. فَإِنَّهُ ثَمَرَةُ الْعِلْمِ. So in this beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that knowledge produces an effect in a person, and that effect is forbearance and clemency. And not only does this hadith allude to the cause of clemency, but also why it's it also alludes to the fact that clemency is something incumbent upon a person and necessary. It's necessary for a person to adopt this characteristic. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, clemency and forbearance are twins that produce great resolution. This hadith doesn't exactly want to say that, you know, the intensity of the ambition or the resolution or the will of a person brings about clemency, but it says that these are kind of go hand in hand with one another. The greater the ambition of a person, the greater clemency he will have. Because obviously, you know, having a big ambition and wanting to do great things, it requires, you know, a lot of forbearance and patience in, you know, bringing about the instruments and means and tools which will lead to the fulfillment of those great objectives. In another beautiful hadith, it's been reported that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, if you are not of the clement ones, then feign clemency. For verily, few people who imitate a group fail to become one of them. This is a very nice hadith. It says if we cannot become clement or we're not clement, we should try to act like the clement people and imitate them. And in this way, eventually we will become clement people. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what brings about clemency in the words and in the light of the hadith of the infallibles, alayhim wassalam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Silence and man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence and man was burning.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The UK's Medical Practitioners Tribunal Service has ruled that Dr. Rahma Al-Adwan is fit to practice, rejecting accusations of anti-Semitism stemming from her social media posts and public appearances. The case, which was brought by a pro-Israel advocacy group, marks the second time the doctor has successfully defended her license against such complaints. The tribunal's decision reinforces the legal distinction between criticism of Israel and anti-Semitism in the context of professional conduct.
There's no purpose having a free speech if it doesn't entitle you to offend other people. And, you know, that's, you know, we live in a democracy and that's meant to be the cornerstone of our society. So Rahma's done nothing here today apart from exercising that right to free speech, and we all must do so.
The pro-Israel groups alleged that Dr. Al-Adwan's precise terminology, specifically her use of Jewish supremacy instead of Zionism, was in itself proof of misconduct. They argued that this linguistic choice amounted to harassment of British Jews and made her a risk to Jewish patients. The tribunal's dismissal of the charges represents a significant legal blow to the strategy of equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism to silence criticism of Israel.
It's clear that this is not an isolated case. Campaigners point to a wider pattern of the pro-Israel lobby in the UK going after professionals who speak up for Palestine, from teachers to lawyers and now to doctors.
Dr. Al-Adwan's supporters have thrown their full weight behind her case. Amongst them were three doctors facing similar allegations in pending tribunals.
As doctors, we respect the sanctity of life, and this genocide goes exactly against that. And in addition, it's not only the genocide in Gaza, naturally, that we strongly oppose and want to stop. We also oppose the Zionist lobby working overtime to suppress doctors' free speech.
The high volume of complaints filed with the GMC against doctors for expressing pro-Palestinian or anti-Zionist views has in itself been labelled a form of harassment.
I felt like there was a sense of shame from GMC Council. They were not there because I've harmed anyone, and they were not there because I'm a danger. They were there so that they do not upset the Israel lobby.
In its decision, the tribunal cited Dr. Al-Adwan's right to freedom of expression under the European Convention on Human Rights, which in a democracy rightly held more authority than the Zionist lobby. Latifa Abu Shahra, Manchester.
An academic and research conference was held at the Iranian Cultural Consulate in Islamabad to commemorate the enduring legacy of Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet, mystic, and Sufi philosopher. The event brought together scholars, intellectuals, and participants from diverse backgrounds who reflected on Rumi's centuries-old message of love, tolerance, and spiritual harmony that continues to inspire millions across the world today.
Rumi's message in all his works is peace and friendship, rooted in the teachings of the Prophet of Islam. At a time when hospitals are being destroyed, children starved, and innocent lives lost in Gaza under the shadow of global powers, his call for compassion and humanity is more urgent than ever.
One of the key highlights of the conference was the launch of Urdu and English editions of Risala-Sipah-e-Salar, a classical Persian text written by one of Rumi's closest disciples. The book offers a rare window into Rumi's life, teachings, and the spiritual influence he left on his followers.
Rumi's poetry is full of love, peace, and humanity. His writings teach us to care for each other and to live with tolerance and harmony.
participants at the gathering stressed that Rumi's message of tolerance, harmony, and coexistence holds deep relevance today, especially in the face of the Gaza genocide, where calls for peace and justice grow louder against Israeli aggression.
The writings and poems of Rumi, from beginning to end, are centered on peace and love. In a world divided by wars and oppression, especially when we see the suffering of innocent Palestinians in Gaza in relation to Israeli oppression, Rumi's message becomes even more urgent because Rumi reminds us that true faith stands with justice, compassion, and the defense of the oppressed.
This literary gathering has become a moment of global reflection, where the centuries-old wisdom of Rumi is being connected with urgent need for peace and compassion, including in Gaza, where the human cost of conflict continues to mount. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Yemen-Israeli in mass numbers Friday to commemorate the martyrdom of late Lebanese resistance leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. They chose to honor him by calling on the Muslim world to carry forward the cause for which Sayyid Nasrallah was martyred.
We choose to commemorate the resistance leader by being ready for battle by land, air, or sea, against the U.S. or the Zionists in occupied Palestine or anywhere in the world. By Allah, we will liberate Palestine from these tyrants and oppressors.
We tell our leader Sayyid al-Houthi, we are your weapons, we are your missiles and drones, ready for you to use us in battle against all those who have wronged us.
On this occasion, protesters also directed strong condemnation against Arab regimes that have chosen to side with Israel.
The American and Zionist Arabs, do you not believe in Allah? You seek support and help from Trump to end the wars. Do you not believe in the power of Allah? You call for Trump to aid you. It is only Allah who can help. Shame on all you Arabs.
Many here said the martyrdom of resistance leaders in recent years have only strengthened their conviction, believing that each sacrifice brings them one step closer to liberating Al-Aqsa.
A day after Israel carried out a wave of airstrikes on the capital, Yemenis are on the streets to reaffirm that the continuous Israeli aggression against their country will not deter Yemen from standing with Gaza. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Italy's opposition five-star movement lawmaker Stefania Ascari has submitted a parliamentary question to Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani and Interior Minister Matteo Piantedosi, requesting explanations over some media reports alleging that about 1,000 Italian citizens, including those with dual Israeli passports, have joined Israel's occupation forces after October 7, 2023, and have participated in the ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. Lawmaker Ascari said on Wednesday that the Italian government has a duty to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and the principles enshrined in the UN Genocide Convention.
The allegations are extremely serious. There could even be more than 1,000 Italian citizens involved. We demand to know the extent of Italy's complicity with terrorist Israel and its genocide in Gaza. We demand answers.
This is how Israel cares about Italian soldiers. About a year ago, Israeli forces started targeting UNIFIL positions in southern Lebanon with three attacks on Italian bases. Italy's defense minister Guido Crosetto called the attack a war crime and summoned the Israeli ambassador to Rome to lodge a formal complaint. Two Italian soldiers were injured in that attack.
Terrorist Israel is in constant breach of international norms. The Israelis think that they are above the law. They are wrong. They have bombarded embassies, sovereign countries. They have attacked Iran, Qatar, in the middle of the negotiations. And now several vessels were targeted by Israeli drones off the coast of Greece.
On Wednesday, a session of the Italian lower house was suspended after a group of opposition lawmakers, including Stefania Ascari, occupied the government benches, demanding that a member of the executive report on the attack on the Global Sumud Flotilla in international waters overnight. The Global Sumud Flotilla, comprising around 50 civilian boats attempting to break Israel's naval blockade of Gaza and deliver humanitarian aid came under attack in the early hours of Wednesday when, according to organizers, drones dropped explosive devices near several boats, causing no injuries.
Loro pietiscono.
Our ministers beg Israel when they should demand security measures for the Italian citizens on board the flotilla. Israel's assault on the flotilla happened in international waters, and it's an act of piracy. It's a crime. In a motion presented some time ago, we said Netanyahu must be stopped, sanctions must be imposed on Israel, and all accords with Tel Aviv must be suspended.
In the aftermath of the attack on the flotilla, the Italian government deployed a multi-purpose frigate to head towards the flotilla for possible rescue operations, focusing primarily on Italian citizens. Max Civili, Rome.
Spain has approved urgent measures against the ongoing genocide in Gaza, standing firmly for human rights and international law. Economy Minister Carlos Cuerpo highlighted the human toll. Over 65,000 killed, 165,000 wounded, and 2 million displaced. Thousands of children face malnutrition. Madrid pledges to lead international pressure on Israel, demanding accountability and pushing for a just and lasting peace.
Spain's new decree, awaiting approval by the Congress of Deputies, enforces a total arms embargo on Israel, prohibiting all defense exports and imports, as well as dual-use products and technology. It also denies transit of aircraft fuels with potential military use and bans imports from illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Advertising of such goods and services is also forbidden, and existing or pending authorizations are revoked.
The minister called on Spain to continue leading international efforts to confront the crisis in Gaza and to ramp up pressure on the Israeli regime. As announced by the Prime Minister and highlighted at this week's UN General Assembly in New York, Madrid aims to hold Israel accountable for its ongoing attacks on Palestinian civilians.
No es el final del camino.
I want to make two proposals. First, the state of Palestine must become a full member of the United Nations, and its integration should be completed as soon as possible. Second, we must take immediate action to halt the brutality and make peace possible. Spain will implement a plan to stop the genocide in Gaza, and will continue taking courageous measures with any who wish to join. History will judge us, and its verdict will be harsh on those who committed this atrocity, and those who remained silent.
The Spanish government has become one of Europe's most outspoken critics of the Israeli regime, leading initiatives that openly reject and condemn its genocidal policies in Gaza, as well as the ongoing expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
Thanks to popular pressure, Spain has approved a total arms embargo on Israel. We will not allow companies or military supplies that fuel the Palestinian genocide to enter our ports or airports. We will remain firm and strengthen the law to close any loopholes.
Spain is now the first EU country to impose a full arms embargo on Israel, a move officials call both symbolic and practical. It highlights Madrid's push for human rights and peace, while raising the question of whether other European nations will follow its lead. Alberto García, Málaga.
Activists gathered in front of the Colombia mission in New York City in support of Colombian President Gustavo Petro's proposal for a UN peacekeeping force for Palestine to help bring an end to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Waving Colombian and Palestinian flags, protesters were seen calling for the global support of the proposal while condemning the U.S.'s habit of vetoing peace strategies to end Israel's atrocities.
And we're here in front of the Colombia mission. We're supporting what they've said, that they're going to make an effective proposal to introduce this United for Peace under a special session of the General Assembly, which they can do right now. Because in the Security Council, where it's been proposed, guess what? 159 countries could say yes, but United States says no, and it all goes in the garbage.
I thought this was a really significant event. I put the word out. Don't see too many other journalists except you guys, because you're always on the scene, really covering what's going on with the Palestine grassroots in this country. And throughout my entire life, I've been hearing all this propaganda about the responsibility to protect and that the United States has this responsibility to come in and stop genocides when they occur. And they even invent genocides so that they can topple governments. And here you have a real stone-cold live-stream genocide, which the International Federation of Genocide Scholars has affirmed, along with the United Nations itself.
On the day that the UNGA debates have kicked off, protesters are flooding the streets in front of the UN headquarters here in New York City to condemn world leaders' inaction regarding Israel's genocide in Gaza. The protesters are also demanding that the UN revoke Israel's membership for constantly violating international laws.
While many have expressed how selective the preservation of international law has become, one protester ensured that the law stood by both Palestine and Iran's side.
We're breaking every international law. I don't have to tell your audience this, but that's why we're standing here in solidarity. The horror is going on every day. None of us can bear it.
This recognizing the state of Palestine, well, you know, that's all well and good, but what is that going to do to save the lives of people in Gaza or to feed the children who are starving? So we're here to say we want action, not just words. And it's especially infuriating when you do hear the words of President Trump that are so demeaning to the rest of the world, so embarrassing.
If any hope lingers of a positive outcome for Palestine at the end of the UNGA high-level week remains unclear, but one thing does not: the steadfastness of the world to ensure a free Palestine. Rachel Hamdoun, New York.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیبه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
A very good day to you, and thank you for joining us here on Iran Radio, where every broadcast is crafted to bring you closer to what matters. And here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. In total, 25 prophets are mentioned in the Holy Quran in different surahs. Prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times in the Holy Quran, making him the most mentioned prophet of all in the Holy Book of Allah. The literal meaning of the word Quran is the which is being read. The word Quran is repeated 70 times in the Book of Allah itself. The month of Ramadan is the only month of the year mentioned in the Holy Quran in verse 185 of Chapter Al-Baqarah, second chapter. This voice is reaching you from the capital Tehran, ready to share a lineup filled with meaning with you. Our upcoming program is Viewpoints, a powerful roundtable where today's most pressing issues from the Islamic world take center stage. From religion to politics, culture to society, we unpack what matters most with a special focus on the latest headlines from Muslim communities across the globe. Following this program, we have another segment of radio productions for this hour. Then it's time for The Teacher, a deep, enriching review of Islamic and Shia theology and ethics. Join our hosts and scholars as they walk us through key principles that shape a conscious and faith-filled life. Coming up next, it's Viewpoints. Stay with us.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to Viewpoints with me, Atal, the host of this program. I'm here with two respected guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mahdi and Sister Zainab. Sister Zainab, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum salam, brother, and to all the listeners this morning.
And Brother Mahdi, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi to you too.
Through what political, social, and religious doctrines can the Muslim lands become united against the hegemony of the West? This is the main question for today's discussion. All right. So, before getting to the doctrines, Sayyid Mahdi, let me ask you a question and
sure.
Answer me honestly. So, aren't the Muslim lands united now? I mean, against the hegemonic power?
I think if we kind of right from the beginning of the discussion make a difference or differentiation or differentiate, I guess, between the people who are in control of these Muslim lands, mm-hmm. whether they're kings or presidents or whatever they may be, and then the actual native people of these lands.
Right.
So for the most part, these are two different players in our overall discussion. When you look at the people across these various Muslim lands, yes, they are united, especially around this